Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting broadcast of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for your listening discomfort. If you don't like new things, learning about history and the future and the present and paying attention in general, then you're probably not going to enjoy the broadcast all that much. You know, it'll be a little bit outside your sphere. Now, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that there is a cancer eating at the planet. It's called reluctance to participate. Have you noticed this? Have you seen this? Everybody's frickin' seen this, haven't you? Because we're all really afraid. Like, oh, but what will people think of me if I go out and fulfill my own destiny and don't do what other people tell me to do and have some kind of self-respect? Other people won't like me anymore. When you've got self-respect, you won't care anymore. Popularity comes from within, all right? If you're really, really happy with yourself and you really love yourself and you love yourself enough to not be a dick to everybody else, you'll be all right. But there's a reason why some people don't have any friends, okay? Don't continue to be their friend if nobody else is continuing. Oh, I'm just feeling really sorry for him. No. I'm sorry. But there are times when the lifeboats need to be let go and these people can be left to rot in their own watery grave that they will dig for themselves and drag you down under if you try to save them. All right? Here's the thing. Remain calm, especially when you're dealing with dicks who are trying to get under your skin, because if you don't, they win. This is a world fraught with danger. Don't let anybody tell you different. All bunches of things will try and stop you from being yourself. But today, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, you can be yourself any way you fucking please. My very special guest. And by the way, we've got no FCC regulations, so we can say whatever we effing want, whatever we fucking want to. It's David Morgan, the Silver Guru, coming at us live from his temple. Buried within the mountainside. The monks pilgrimage from far and yonder away, carrying their coloured flags as they walk up the mountainside. Welcome back to the show, even though you've never been here before.
Thank you for having me, Vinny. I'm really looking forward to it. I have listened to several of your shows. I certainly wouldn't say all of them, that would be a lie, but love your sense of humor, love how you dig things out, and your free-flowing format, so I'm really looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it ever since you made contact with me, so... I'm ready. When you're ready.
All right. I have that impression on people. Now, would you be able to give us a little bit of background on yourself and what it is you do?
My fascination with money came at an early age. I don't know why. It just was sort of something that was ingrained in me, I guess. I was 11 years old, and my dad would pay me 25 cents a week to water his orchard by hand. Now, when you're 11, you get bored really easy, and he's had these great big circular troughs around each fruit tree, and it seemed like it took an hour to water each one. It probably took 10 minutes, but he had to fill it full of water, and move the next one. Anyway, the point being, I'm belaboring this a lot, but so I got nothing but 90% quarters for week after week after week, and we lived in the country, and I really had no place to spend them, and I've always been kind of a saver, and so I had this... basically, probably about 10 bucks thinking about it, the stack of silver quarters I had. And one day I got this Cupro nickel quarter, this quarter that was basically a slug. And as an 11-year-old kid, that really impressed me that something was wrong, that, something wasn't right. If these quarters are all silver, this one obviously something different. And what does that mean? And the adults didn't seem to take any, notion to it at all. But I did. So that was kind of the spark that lit the fire. By the time I was 16, I asked my dad if I could start trading stocks, and he said, no, you have to be 18. And actually he looked into it for me, and there's a thing in the United States called the Uniform Gift to Minors Act. I don't know if it still exists or not. I mean, I'm well past that age now. But if your parents sign it, you're allowed to go ahead and start trading stocks in the stock market. So I started trading at 16. And then I just started getting into kind of the monetary history thing. And if you really want to mess up your life, and I know you've done a good job of yours, Vinny, and I mean that as a compliment, being your own individual, taking, not really caring what others think of you and that kind of thing, being a maverick. You know, I read like None Dare Call Conspiracy when I was like 18. And by that time, you know, I was well acquainted with the Federal Reserve being a private banking corporation. And I started to spread the word. And of course, in those days, without the internet or any way to prove it real time, you know, now you can prove it with your iPhone. Well, you, look, John, there it is. But you couldn't do that in those days. I was ostracized, outcast, made fun of, et cetera. But it really didn't bother me to know what the truth was. So I'm belaboring this a lot. So my first love was finance. I wanted to go into it. I told my dad that. He thought I wanted to be a stockbroker. He blew up and threw the encyclopedia set at me. I'm exaggerating. But I went back and read the World Book Encyclopedia's Guide to Careers. And I went through the whole book in a weekend. And I read about it. I said, oh, I want to be an airline pilot, man. I'm like 14 years old by this time, 14, 15. And I think, wow, you only work half the days of the month to make $80,000 a year. This is back, 40 years ago. And no more than that. And, you know, I'm thinking stewardesses. I mean, I'm thinking like, man, what is better than flying for a living? So I tell my dad, Dad, I want to fly. He says, great. So at 16, I started flying. And I got a degree in aeronautical engineering from one of the better schools in the country at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo. Graduated and started working in the test airplane field as a crew member. So that's kind of the fast other part of my life. When I was in that field for a brief time, I associated and did briefings with and flew with the test pilots. And they were all into like, you know, they were all making some pretty tall money working for corporations. And when you fly in the test airplane field, you get paid extra every flight. And, you know, these checks are pretty sizable. So they were reading these financial newsletters, and we'd sit out there in the truck on the runway waiting to do like an engine run or something. And I'm just a 20-something-year-old kid in the back seat, but my ears are listening to every word that these, you know, the gods, the test pilots are saying. And they're reading this stuff that's making total sense to me because of my financial interests. And I know that this guy is really on the beat, and he's talking about, you know, kind of off the wall investments that most people never even hear about, like gold, you know, silver, you know, why the economy is going to decline and all this stuff. So that sort of piqued my interest in the newsletter industry. So I've really beaten around the bush here. It's explaining how I was really fascinated by money, finance, and how I was acquainted in the newsletter business. But that's how it all began for me. Once I was laid off in the aircraft industry, I did work for some brokers. I did do some trading. I have traded for a living before, but with the internet, I started, and I did some consulting, but mostly once the internet came about, I started my own newsletter service, and that was right around 1999. So I've been at this for about 17 years on the net, and it took a while to get traction, but I was, me and a couple other guys, the only guys really specific to silver, and I do a lot more than that, as you know, but it is my forte. It's what I'm really the most interested in, precious metals-wise. I love gold, but I think silver is a superior investment. And so that just has built up and fallen down and starting to rebuild. I mean, I had a great run between, say, 2008 and 2011, and then from 2011 up until the end of the year last year, the business just kept declining and declining. And I don't want to be a whiner. It's just the way it goes. But like a good quarterback in the U.S., I tried not to get too high when things are high, and I tried not to get too low when things were low. And right now we're back on the mend. So very long introduction. I usually don't like to talk too much about my favorite subject, me, but you have me for 2 hours. So I guess we'll keep going.
Yeah, let's elaborate. I wanted to talk as well about silver's history. On top of that, because I was skimming through a lot of the foreword to your book and some of the things. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is the book right here on the screen for those of you on the YouTube listener. The Silver Manifesto is the new book that they're trying to get out there, and you can get that on David's website. And coincidentally, today, an Australian listener of mine sent me these little beautiful Australian coins. I got one with a little kookaburra on it, and one with a very freaking scary giant funnel web spider on it. They got lots of those in Australia. Scary things. And I'm just thinking, like, silver, what's so important about it, right? Because is it like a magpie thing? You know, you look and it's shiny and it looks pretty, and therefore you develop some kind of an attachment to it. That's how it starts. But this is something that has been valued by humanity for a very, very long time. So it's more than just how it looks. When it comes to precious metals, and I have been hearing a lot about this, and it's attached to crisis. And it's interesting that you say that you experienced a decline from the period of between, a growth from 2008 through 2011, because that was right after that big 2008 financial crash, when a lot of people were starting to think about, hey, man, we've got to start securing. The wealth is evaporating. We need real assets and things of that nature. But I've spoken to a number of people trading on the stock market, and they've told me that about 90-something odd percent of the gold and silver that's allegedly in circulation is just paper. It doesn't really exist unless you've got it in your hand. You're holding nothing.
Right. So I'll retrace a little bit before the webcam fell over. Silver's been used as money more places more often and for far more transactions than gold. And then what you're exactly right to follow up with what you just said, Vinny. There is roughly, it depends whose analysis you look at and what you term to be a paper product. But for the futures only, we're looking at about 100-to-1 ratio. And gold as well. So for every ounce of physical that exists on the planet, there's about 100 fictional ounces against that, or let's just say against that, that's out there floating in the financial market. So
that sounds very similar to the marijuana black market. For every ounce that you can actually get your hands on, there's 100 ounces you can't.
Well said. That's about it. So what people don't seem to grasp, and some do, of course, is that everything runs on supply and demand. And yes, all the markets are manipulated. And yes, the precious metals, especially probably the silver market. But regardless, they still move on supply and demand. And what that means is if you create a fictional piece of silver by putting out a paper product, then that adds to the supply. That adds to the supply. And for most people that don't even care if they ever hold the physical silver in their hand or not, like you just showed, it doesn't matter to them. So if they're buying a contract and the price goes up or down, depending which side they're betting, you can bet it's going up in price. You can bet it's going down in price. They could give a fig one way or the other, as long as they're going to get their check from the brokerage house or a counterparty. So that's the problem throughout the marketplace. But when you specifically dial in on silver, what you find is that the ratio of paper to physical is extreme relative to any other market, oil, wheat, soybeans, cotton, gold, anything else. It's extreme in silver, which means it slides both directions. Any disruption in the silver market from the physical realm could actually wreak havoc with the paper players. And I think we may be getting to that point right now, believe it or not.
What makes you say that?
Well, it makes me say that is silver has been trading differently since the beginning of the year. And we're at an all-time OI, which is called open interest, which is the amount of paper players that are out there. And what's taken place for about the last 6 months, from the best analysis that I can do, and I'm known to do pretty good work, is that the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which is primarily a physical exchange, is taking on the COMEX. In other words, for the people, the paper paradigm and the paper pushers that are always able to push it the direction they want when they want it, are having trouble doing it this time. They've tried to orchestrate a couple of sales on the silver market from the paper price perspective, and they've met with actually miserable failure so far, which means the other side, the longs, which is primarily, again, from the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which is the Chinese, they're basically well-funded, got deep pockets in the paper markets. In other words, they have a lot of fictional cash or currency, I should say. And it looks like they're willing to take on these guys, which is a perfect setup for a short squeeze. What you really want with the short squeeze is that the price keeps going up and the shorts start to sweat because they're betting the price is going down and it goes up, and they're betting more that it's going down and it goes up. They're betting even more that it's going down and it goes up. And at some point, they might decide, you know what, we got to lighten our load. We're losing too much money here. You know, the head of the bank just came by our trading room here and told me, you know, we're off on the silver market, take our losses and get the hell out. But once that happens, then that starts to force the price up even higher, because to offset a short or a sell, they've got to buy. So it really could start in on something. And now if you're ready for the short squeeze, meaning you know what's going on, and you go into the physical market at the same time the paper market's going high. It used to be called a Texas long. It was what the Hunt brothers were accused of. So they had lots of paper contracts and they had lots of physical markets. So when the market started going up, they started buying physical, which makes the market even tighter because of that 100-to-1 ratio. So you got to think that for every ounce of physical they're taking off the market, in a way, you can think about it taking like 100 ounces out of the paper market. So is that going to happen? I don't know. What I am seeing is we are in a situation I have not seen for a very, very long time in the silver market. It's pretty exciting, but, you know, I want to stay solid. I want to be grounded. I don't want to get too hypey. I've had, you know, a reputation as one of the guys out there that's not overly zealous about the silver market and kind of calm, cool, and collected most of the time. It does excite me. It's an exciting market. And I have to, I guess, finish with this, Vinny. If you have to bet percentage-wise, you kind of have to bet with the banks because they seldom lose and they have infinite money. They created out of nothing. So right now, as bullish as I am, it looks as if we will get some kind of correction or pullback here probably within the next few weeks. But I don't think it's going to be to the degree that we've witnessed in the past. We're definitely in a bull market again. And more people are waking up, you know, especially, and thank you for having me on your show, because this will enlighten some people, whether they have money to put in the silver market or not. You know, I don't have no way of knowing, but what at least just getting the message out there will help others. And there's a lot more to the story than, you know, just financial wealth. And I'm sure we can go on to, into that later in your show.
I've found that the financial system is, let's say it's mired and undermined by an entire political system and religious system and so on and so forth, like these unseen hidden factors that affect the market. I'm kind of wondering what the hell that is.
Sure. Well, I'll do about a 3 or 4 minute rant. I'll try. I won't be as good as you as your intro, but I'll do it. Everything's corrupted. I mean, the political system is corrupted, the monetary system is corrupted, the financial system is corrupted, the legal system is corrupted, the health system is corrupted, the food chain is corrupted, the water is corrupted, and the air is corrupted. There's nothing out there in our lives as a normal, natural-born human that isn't corrupted. I mean, the food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the political class that we are supposed to obey, which some of us do and some of us don't, regardless, everything has been corrupted. So really, if you speak, one of my favorite quotes, Vinny, is speaking the truth during, what is it? Gosh, I'm excited. It's an Orwellian quote, George Orwell. Speaking the truth
in the time of universal deceit is a revolutionary act.
Yeah. And that's where we're at. I mean, everything's corrupt. So, you know, coming, and they're all tied together, really. And of course, the thing I want to talk about on a political scene that very few people say is this. You know, you get these arguments. I'm in the Green Party, or I'm in the Libertarian Party, or Democrat, or Republican, or I'm a socialist, or I'm a fascist, or I'm a communist, or I'm a, you know what? I don't give a fig what you are. Everything, and I mean everything, is controlled by the banking elite on top of every political system. So smoke that for a while. I mean, if you really think about it, if you're a communist, you know, or let's say you're in a new Russia, and I have nothing against Putin, I've got nothing for him. I'm pretty much a political atheist. It's hard to be that, but I try. But, you know, if you're thinking, you know, this guy's great, think again. He's controlled by what? The banking elite. Well, let's go over to Canada, kind of a neutral country. Well, what are they controlled by? The banking elite. Well, let's go to a neutral country, Switzerland. What are they controlled by? Well, they are the banking elite. I mean, the BIS is there. I mean, so you really think it through, it's kind of a, it's almost like theater to have all these political ideologies. Of people, oh, man, I don't know, if we just got this person in there, things will get better. If we just adopted this new law or this new regulation. You know, the bankers just laugh. They laugh. Look, the only way you're going to instrument real, honest-to-God change is if you change the way money works. If you don't change the way money works, it doesn't matter how many political changes there are. It's not going to change anything. Am I making my point? I hope I am, because this is critical to understanding what's really going on.
Well, I've said on a couple of shows is that enforcing the law might help, you know, because it's like fraud, creating stuff out of thin air with no consideration, no actual value attached to the money that you're creating is fraud, and they're doing it the whole time. So if the law was enforced, that'd be great. And somebody asked me on Facebook this morning, but Vinny, how come the laws aren't getting enforced? And I go, well, it's a circular argument, you see. The problem with corruption is that the laws don't apply to it because of the corruption.
I love your sense of humor. It's about the only way to keep your sanity these days.
Have you noticed that a whole lot of good guys have either gone bad or stopped fighting the evil altogether because they lost their sense of humor about it, bro?
Yeah. Oh, you got to. I mean, it is. And I'm not known to have a great sense of humor, but I do appreciate one. And certainly, you know, I can laugh at myself and at others, and you can't take it too seriously. I mean, they are losing. That's kind of the paradox, or that a lot of people don't see, is that things look the strongest when they're actually failing. In other words, they may look like the police state is getting ever stronger in the United States, and from a lot of perspectives or points of view, it is. But what that's lengths to try to keep their power, because if they, you know, if they had all the power, they could just do it with, you know, uniformed personnel type of thing. But they don't. They've got to put out these, you know, SWAT unit type of situations in, you know, major cities and everything else. So they are losing their grip. They really are.
And in terms of losing the grip, how do you see that really manifesting? Because I'm kind of like, it's like, have you ever tried to drink water out of the palm of your hand because you didn't have a cup?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and if you tried to prevent that water from escaping by tightening your hands, more of the water comes out because it just slips through your fingers. It's sort of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you my 3 cents because, you know, I get asked it a lot. And believe me, if I knew, I'd speak from the head and heart and tell everybody it's going to be just like this. First of all, it's going to be different than probably anyone's imagined. Secondly, it'll be different in different locations. And lastly, if you go to my website, themorganreport.com, and you just give me an email and a first name, we'll send you the report that I wrote. I wrote every bit of it. It's called The Riches and Resources. And what's in that report are 2 movies. One is called The Four Horsemen film, which talks about the age of empire and the decline of it, which is a great history lesson for everyone. And the other one is a movie that used to be called The Empty ATM. It's been renamed, but this gets right to the heart of your question, Vinny, and that is, what is it going to look like? This is a documentary, extremely well done, on the financial or currency collapse of the year 2000 in Argentina. Now, in Argentina, as you probably well know, I know how well studied you are, but our viewers may not know, or our listeners. And that is, they did what I would call a pseudo bail-in. What the Argentine banks did was they said, oh, your money's safe, Vinny. You're 20,000 quid are here in the bank, but you can't get to it. We're just going to hold it here for safekeeping. What we're going to do is we're going to allow you to go to the ATM and pull out 300 a week. Into perpetuity, you know, for every, you know, it's there. Say, well, in the meantime, they devalued it, so you couldn't like get your 20 grand out of there and move it into a different currency or move it into gold or something. So now it's locked in the bank, but you have access to it only at $300 per week. And of course, this really screwed the whole country. So what took place, and you'll see it in the documentary, and I highly recommend everybody watch this documentary, because, well, what's it going to be like? Well, look at one that actually took place. So at least you kind of get the flavor of what really happened. This is not fiction. This is not made up. This is 16 years ago, but it's pretty, you know, fairly recent. So everybody in these towns at noon during the lunch hour would get pots and pans and big spoons, and they would beat on the walls of the banks all, you know, throughout the country. I mean, it was kind of a uniform agreement for all the citizenry to grab something to whack on the side of the bank and let them know in a really nonviolent. I mean, you're just pounding up, you know, something on the side of a wall. You're not destroying property or anything. They'll let the bankers know how upset they were. So they had like a lot of open air forums, or we call them flea markets here in the States. I don't know what you call them there, but, and so people gather, people are, you know, people are survivalists. People have a survival instinct. People usually get along in a community. And so they'd have these open forums and they would trade, you know, food for haircuts and, you know, and did silver and gold do well? Yes. And what's interesting, I read a paper from one of these people that lived in Argentina at the time. He wrote it very long, and I read it twice, about a 30-page, I'll just call it a diary, of what it was like during this financial crisis. And what was interesting, and I never really thought about it that much, was a lot of silver jewelry was used as currency, because a lot of jewelry is stamped, you know, sterling, which is 92.5% pure silver, not 999 fine, but, you know, 92.5%. And I never really thought of it, but, you know, a ring, a bracelet, a necklace, or whatever. So that was used. And of course, a lot of other things. I mean, people do what they have to do. The one comment I'll add, and again, I urge everyone to watch it, and just go to my website, get that free report, and you could click the hot link to watch the movie, was the economic finance minister of all of Argentina made this comment, and I can't quote it, but the essence of it is, I am amazed at how civil and quiet the population is remaining during this crisis. And boy, when he said that during his documentary, I said, oh boy, did he say a mouthful, because I doubt we would see that kind of civil and moral behavior in this country if it were to happen.
Especially not with about 30% of the population on psychoactive medications that they won't be able to get their fucking hands on anymore, that actually affect you worse when you stop taking them than when you do take them. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. You know, it'll make the Columbine shooting seem like a day at the beach.
Oh, you got my humor, but you're very accurate in what you say, and it is scary. So, you know, I mean, that was the one line in that documentary that I said, yeah, you know, I was amazed too. I mean, of course, you know, I don't know who made the documentary. I mean, I'll give them credit. I'm sure it's in the movie credits. And they might have, did they take sweet spots or did you do a full open, you know, forum type of documentary that accurately portrayed everything? I don't know. It sure looked to me like they did a great job of trying to show you, you know, everything accurately. But, you know, again, I'll just repeat myself. That's a far cry from what I think would take place in the U.S. and I think other places as well. I don't think the Europeans would be as well behaved as the Argentinians were, or basically anybody else for that matter. So, you know, were it to occur, and I think it will at some level, this is something that, you know, you need to be prepared for. And I'll add on to that, Vinny, because I've tried to do, you know, my best for others. And it really boils down to not so much what if your financial house is in order or if you've saved in silver or gold. What really matters more than that is what your attitude is. If you're mentally prepared, or more importantly, emotionally prepared, that is what is really going to get you through. You're better off with zero silver and zero gold and a strong attitude and a strong belief that you can weather the storm and that your emotional wherewithal will stay with you and you won't just flip out the day the banks close. You're far better prepared than someone that maybe is addicted to their monetary, you know, the amount of money they have, be it real money or not. So you really have to be, and I guess I can go in any land that we want, but, you know, you got to be spiritually based in a way. You got to really know to thine own self be true what you are and what your value is and not the value external to yourself. If you don't have that internal value that you kind of talked about at the beginning of your show, about, you know, you don't really give a fig if somebody likes you or not. If you're solid with who you are, what you are, and you've got high integrity, if you can tell the truth to power, if you can speak the truth during these extraordinary times and be a rebel, move on. You know, you're in a good place. So and that's something I've strived to do more and more, Vinny, is to let people know that it's not all about money. I mean, if you go back maybe 10 years ago for me, I would stress that, sound financials, hedges like gold and silver are probably not all you needed. But I've changed that thinking quite some time ago, because it's going to take a heck of a lot more than that because of the way the breakdown is going to look.
Now, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention here. I think it's what people act like during a crisis initially, at least, and the importance of keeping your head, because that's, as you mentioned, that's the number one survival tool. And it's usually the one that people forget, but it's one that they can never forget to take with them. It's your head. It's your brain, right? And the other survival tool that most people do forget and don't remember how important it is when they run out of it is toilet paper. Mm-hmm. All right. Think about that shit, ladies and gentlemen. Think about it. All right. Now, I also wanted to get along to starvation. This is the other one. You need food. You need water. You need shelter. Right? And you need love, generally speaking. You won't survive without that either. But if you don't have your food and your water and your shelter, etc., sorted out, you're going to have to get it sorted out really quickly. But just remember, other people are going to be trying to do this as well. And your number one enemy will become men who have hungry kids.
Exactly. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, that's a scenario. Is it going to go that far? I don't know. Do I think it could? Absolutely. And you just have to be prepared again mentally at the beginning. But, you know, having extra food, it's a no-lose bet. I mean, if you had some extra cash or were able to save, you know, $20 a week or whatever, you're far better off by building up a food reserve than you are buying, you know, silver. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. And, you know, some people are doing it, some aren't. There's people that, you know, the vast majority have a normalcy bias. I mean, most people believe that tomorrow is going to be like today. The grocery store is always going to be open. You can buy grapes any time of the year. That thing, you know, we're in this never land. It's only going to get better. And that, you know, life goes on tomorrow like it did today. But this is proven in history not to be true. In fact, a good book to read, I think it's John Teeter that wrote it, that's called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he went through societies from like the Byzantine, the Mesopotamian, the Roman, Mayan, all these empires, and the collapse of these complex societies. And I got through the book. It was kind of a tough read, and I love to read, but it was a bit of an academic read. And, you know, and there were like several takes on each empire's collapse. Like some of the analysts would say, well, it was weather, or some would say it was food crisis. In most cases, I would argue it's the monetary system. But regardless of what caused the collapse, I got done with the book and said, well, I really want to get something out of this book. And I'm really sort of not getting anything. And then, of course, it hit me. I did the one-handed clap. Oh, my goodness. And it isn't that profound. It's profound in a way. But you probably wouldn't even have to read the book to get this. But what, regardless of the cause, was it monetary? Was it political? Was it weather? Was it war? What really the bottom line is, it doesn't matter what starts the collapse. Once it starts down, nothing, and I mean nothing, will start it back up. And that's the point. So that will lead into this. The collapse in the global financial empire really did start in 2008. And we're just deluding ourselves. This is delusion. Delusion is when all facts and information are contrary to the belief system. So this belief system that, you know, anyone that says the economy isn't doing well is peddling fiction is, you know, I mean, what more BS do we have to hear than that? Because the truth is, we really haven't recovered from the start of the collapse. And again, going to my premise, once it starts down, you can't pick it back up again.
The bailout was essentially injecting morphine into somebody who just had a really bad wound, but they didn't reset it properly, essentially, so it's still hemorrhaging. And I think, like, during the last depression in the United States, about 10 million people starved to death. That was at a time when 90% of people lived in rural areas growing their own food. Today, 90% of people live in cities and do not grow their own food. Now, during the Depression, people were really freaking independent, okay? Not only did they grow their own food, they made their own clothes, okay? They did a hell of a lot of chores. They were really fit and healthy in general, because there weren't a whole lot of GMO foods and candy was reasonably scarce and things of that nature. So, look, if something really bad does happen, don't freaking panic, all right? Because there'll be plenty of people to do that for you. but I was just thinking about this the other day. Speaking to something that's really funny. See an article that comes up and it says, Ireland is starting to arrest its bankers that caused the 2008 crash. And you know, it's real funny because New Zealand's Prime Minister used to be working in Ireland during the derivatives phase back then, which helped cause the Irish crash. So we don't arrest our bankers that caused the 2008 financial crash. We get them to leave the fucking country, bro. You can't make this shit up. And there was also this analogy between, you were talking about the shorting and these big groups of people who have fake amounts of silver and people who've actually got real stuff, and they're sort of like in this sort of little war right now. And it reminded me of like one time I was sitting at a table and I had nothing and I was bluffing, and the other guy only had two pair, but he knew that I was bluffing, so I kept pissing my money away. And then all of a sudden this guy was the big stack, and then he's got all the money, right? Real. All got all the chips. And it doesn't matter how good anybody else's game is, he's going to wind up getting everybody else's chips eventually because he's got the big stack.
Yeah, and that's, I use that analogy often. It's a very, very good one. And that's how this paper paradigm is played. I mean, the banks have, you know, $12 million in chips sitting in front of them, and you're starting off with $100,000. You think you're going to win that poker game? No way.
So when we think about this, it's not about winning the poker game, okay? The game's already lost, essentially. You just got to walk away from the table and retain what you can and ride it out, sort of like a storm. The best way to ride it out is either to be right in the eye of it and just prepare as much as you can, just hope for the best, right? Now, you made a point as well about faith, about having hope and something beyond yourself. Now, I have that faith, and I got solidified when I had a look at the survival rates of POWs in Vietnam. The ones who were real strong, orthodox, religious people who were locked away in these Vietnamese camps with no hope of rescue survived a hell of a lot more often than the people who believed in nothing. Now, it's because when you are alone and you don't believe in anything, you're truly alone. When you believe in something, it doesn't matter what you believe, I found. If you call your God Krishna or Allah or God, as Christians do, right? It doesn't matter. That belief gives you power. That's what all the religions have been talking about this whole time when they say the one truth, is that you think that there's a being that is more powerful than you, that is there to protect you and give you guidance. And just because you think it's there, it does. That's the human power.
Yeah, I'll just add a little on that. I mean, I forget the author's name, but I should know it. I think I do, but I don't want to be called a fool. But Man's Search for Meaning, I mean, during the World War II camps, I mean, that's a very powerful book. And again, goes right to the heart of what you just said.
So don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, have some faith. You'll frickin' survive this. And if you don't, also another study that I found was very interesting is that people who have terminal illnesses have a lot less painful deaths if they have strong faith as well, right? So it doesn't matter what your faith is. It doesn't matter what you believe. Just believe it. Now, getting in back into the silver manifesto, because I wanted to talk specifically about this historical significance of silver in and of itself, because when we talk about currency, currency is pretty important. It's a store and a transfer of energy. A certain amount of energy went into making these wee silver coins, right? And a certain amount of energy got deployed by somebody who delivered them to my door in his bicycle shorts. So what is the connection here between having currency as a store of energy, and why is that actually so much more efficient than the whole barter system, or like, I'll do something for you, you do something for me? Because a whole bunch of people have been talking to me about this, and I'm like, no, I think having storable energy like this that you can trade for any kind of transmutable form of energy or effort that you want is a far superior method of not only exchange, but interchangeable exchange. Because I'm multi-talented, right? And I could perform many different services for someone in exchange for X amount of things, but it might be a bit difficult to use that for every single transaction, because that means I've got to bust my ass to live, and I don't like doing that. People do that all the time. It's called a job. Fuck that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's called division of labor. And it is the most efficient way to do things. So and now in this environment that we are globally, division of labor becomes more and more important Because if you are talented to be someone that writes code for a computer, and that's your talent, then you can do that for exchange of money, which means it's the highest and best use of your particular talent. Or if you are a farmer and you're growing non-GMO crops, then that's the highest and best use for you. Plus, a lot of it also opens the opportunity not only for the division of labor, which means everyone's working at their most efficient pace. Is that true across the board? No, but at least it offers the opportunity for that. So everyone can, in theory, do their highest and best good in passion, hopefully, at least some are. And that means that you've got absolutely the best society you can have, because we all agree that this piece of metal is exchangeable between us. And that way we don't have to worry about finding somebody and be an intermediary between someone that needs a pair of shoes, a loaf of bread, and a set of screwdrivers. You know, I mean, barter works, but it's very inefficient. Money is the most efficient way to transact business. And because of that, the division of labor works so well, and it makes the best society. And really, if you have a sound money-based system, you get a gentle deflation that we put in the book. And we explain that deflation really isn't all that bad, because what it means is, first of all, you don't need a financial planner, Vinny. I mean, if you know a dollar is a dollar, and a dollar is going to be a dollar for your whole lifetime and your children's lifetime and their children's lifetime. God, what a concept. Money actually retains its value throughout three or four generations, and it can. Then you know that, you know, your lifestyle, I'll just make up a number because the number is important. It's the idea that's important. But if you have 50,000 of those units per year, you know that when you hit 60 or 70 or whenever you decide to, you know, go to part-time instead of full-time or retire, that if you had saved 50,000 of those units, they're going to buy exactly the same thing that they did, you know, 40 years before when you started your career, and more. And the reason it buys more is because things become more efficient. Think about the first cell phone and what it looked like compared to the iPhone today. And think of what the cost of the first cell phone was compared to the cost of the iPhone today. That's called efficiency. As you ramp up in efficiency, things get better and cost less, which means you have a gentle deflation in a sound monetary system. So everybody actually gets everything, something that most people want, a higher standard of living at a lower cost. What a concept. Sound money works really, really well. Of course, it's based on a couple of presuppositions, which we laughed about at the beginning. We probably need to report now, because we don't need tomatoes thrown at us, and, you know, I'm too old to dodge them. But that's based on the presupposition that we have a rule of law that works, that everyone has the same rules, laws, and accountability as everybody else. You can't be a criminal at the top of the pile and do everything wrong about top secret information and just say, well, she didn't mean to do it, so no harm, no foul. I mean, come on, what kind of society is that? I mean, the whole premise of the American system was the same rules, laws, and accountability for everybody. In fact, let me get on a rant here for a second, Vinny. The idea was so strong that the citizen was the most important player in the political structure in the beginning of the foundation of the country. The president, vice president, the judicial system, everybody answered to the citizenry. That's the way it was set up, because in a rule of law, it means the inalienable rights. You can't put a lien against them. They're God-given, or at least nature-given, their natural rights, and that those are protected. So their God-given, constitutionally secured right, the document was written to secure your God-given rights. That's what it's about, and that's what everyone at service was supposed to protect, from the executive branch, the legislatures, and the judicial branch. But I'm off my rant. We all know that, you know, my political atheism goes this far, Vinny, and I'll sum it up and come back to your next question. You know, I really don't give a dig what the political structure is. In the, I care about the political structure. Let me reframe that. I really want one thing, regardless of whatever party is in power, because they all take an oath to uphold the Constitution. That's all I want. Do what you swore to do. Uphold the Constitution to all powers and enemies, foreign and domestic. And none of these frickers do it at all. You know, but they all swear to, you know, take a public oath that they will. I mean, this is how corrupt things are. You know, I mean, my favorite word, corruption, but it's just pervasive. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere on the planet by almost everyone. The only real integrity that you find anywhere is in pretty much the alternative media. And, you know, there's people in the general public that have it too. But the only people with integrity that speak out about it and do, you know, for lack of a better word, journalism, are people like you that have the cojones to sit there and tell the truth. And again, it's very powerful to speak truth to power. And actually, if you go back to archetypes, the one person that could actually take down the king was the court jester. So you're in the right spot at the right time, Vinny, with your sense of humor, because it was the jester that could actually bring the truth to light, and the king wouldn't behead him because the jester was loved by everybody. So keep on doing what you're doing, my friend. You're making a difference. You really are.
Yeah, I'll bring him to justice. Now, I think about this as well. I remember what it was down with my mate Chris Wardell. His daughter got taken off him by the family services, and it was a whole big corrupt affair, and they were like farming her out to these criminal pedophiles and things like that. And while we were down there, they gave me this big hat to stay warm kind of thing, and I was like prancing around. Look, I'm the New Zealand family court jester. Oh god, it was good. I love pedophile jokes; they're freaking amazing. Anyway, I wanted to get into this whole aspect because currency is good, right? We understand this far more efficient means of exchange than barter. Although I reckon currency plus barter is the superior system, really, because it means that if you ain't got the currency, you've at least got your labour, and that's more or less what we've got now. Except the problem is you've got to do some labour for some currency and then go out and get whatever the hell you want. And I prefer to X that out when possible. But the importance of the system is because it's being controlled, and it's being controlled by people who don't follow the system's own effing rules. Now, if you've got a whole system in place, let's say the justice system, the legal system, or the financial system, etc., and it has all these rules that are supposed to be there, that it won't go out of whack, etc. This is how you're supposed to do it properly, everybody. But then you have a society that is brought up to not think for themselves, not question things that authorities are telling them. Now, as a result, after the first generation of that people who aren't thinking for themselves and take what authority says as gospel, they'll then train the next generation who will be even dumber and be even less prone to question and fuck things up even worse than the first group of people that you dumbed down and brainwashed in the first place, all right? It's like, have you ever taken a photocopy of your ass and then taken a photocopy of the photocopy of your ass and how the bunghole starts to get a little bit blurry? You know, see, it just doesn't work. Ladies and gentlemen, if you pass down stupidity generation to generation, you're supposed to improve society one generation at a time. And I like this quote, I use it a lot, it's a Greek saying. It says, you plant a tree whose shade you know you will never sit in.
Very good. Right. Well, it reminds me of the movie Idiocracy, which is one that it's sort of a B movie that not many people know about, but if there's Netflix or whatever streaming type of video system you have anywhere in the world, try to find Idiocracy. It's basically a guy that is put in a cryogenic chamber, and he's like the most average dude out there. And then he comes out of this deep freeze. I forget what it was, but like four generations later, he's like a genius. He's like so smart because the whole society has been dumbed down so greatly that this very average guy is like a super intellect. It's very hilarious, but it actually, from my perspective, and it's a studied perspective, is kind of an accurate situation. I mean, the societies at large are being dumbed down with this common core and, you know, no child left behind and all this stuff sounds good. They always use these words that really sound great. I mean, the Patriot Act and, you know, all this stuff, it sounds like, well, if you're not for that, you must be, you know, criminal or something, you know.
You must be acting unpatriotic.
Exactly. Back to you, Vinny. I'm done with that one.
I find that people are like panicking all over the web, and it's just like the first bit of bad news they hear, they just fly off the handle and they're freaking out about everything very, very quickly. The drop of a hat, man, and it's like there's this aggression that's sitting in as well, man. of getting very, very sick of it every single time I go and check my Facebook comments in the morning and my YouTube comments in the morning. And every single time, it's like, ugh, stupid comment from somebody who didn't watch the video, stupid comment from somebody who did watch the video but didn't understand anything that was said during it, and just block, 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 block. And it just... it frustrates me that there's billions of people on this planet, and for some reason, you can't block all of them on the social media. You actually have to deal with them. You actually have to see their comments. You have to hear about them. They have to accost you. They have to send you emails. They have to, they have to, they have to. And there's no escape from it, right? There's no evolutionary step that's going to happen that's going to make suddenly the whole of the population suddenly not really selfish, ignorant pieces of trash. And I found that there isn't really a coping mechanism for it other than to detach yourself for it, from it.
Well, I don't bother with it. I mean, I have social media all over the place. I mean, I've got, like, I don't know, I looked today, I haven't looked a long time, it's either 25 or 29,000 on Twitter. And most of that I post, it's either me or one of my team, because the only people that have the password to my Twitter account are myself and my two analysts that work with us. But and that's a good way to get a news feed on stuff that really is pertinent to what's going on from an economic perspective. But I have a VA, a virtual assistant, that handles the Twitter, the Facebook, the YouTube, and pretty much I just tell her, unless if they're swearing or really, you know, derogatory, just take it off. But I don't have time because, you know, even at my ripe old age and as thick a skin as I have, which is pretty good, I am still an open-hearted human. And, you know, some of these comments could get you. I just don't bother, Vinny. I mean, that's my solution. It's like, you know, because like you said at the beginning of your show, you know, someone thinks of me is really going to change me now. Sticks and stones may break my bones and all that. No, words can have an effect. And certainly, you know, especially you get three in a row. And it's really disheartening to put a lot of effort into something and do a lot of research and put it up there. And then someone just like, you're kidding me. Did you listen to the video? That's the exact opposite. I'll give you a real quick one and we can move on. But that's my solution. I pay people, and it's not a lot, to just take care of this social media, because I put up what I think is of value. And if you don't like it, then go somewhere else. I mean, I've been a one percenter, and I don't mean from an elitist standpoint at all, but less than 1% of the population of the planet owns any physical precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium. It's really more like 0.5%. So if I'm in that league of those idiots that think that honest money and truth and integrity in the financial system means something, and I am, I fought for it my entire life, you know, and I'm only in 0.5% of the population. Do you think that about 99.5% don't really care for me? Yeah, they probably don't, but I don't need to hear from them. Anyway, the point is, in a free market, if you like the Vinny Eastwood show, then pass it on. Make sure everybody hears about it. And if you disagree with something, try to be open-minded enough to find out why that other perspective exists before you form an opinion. Everybody's like, oh, well, you know, they have to say that. This thing, sorry, I'm hitting on a rant. I'm going to continue on this rant for a second.
No, you're not, because that's the point. Perfect timing, Cannibal. All right, so save that thought. We'll come back to it. All right. Do you know that I failed improvisation class in university? Right. And I also got kicked out of a drama class one time because I didn't like the dance moves. Both times I told the instructor, fuck you, I'm better than you. And I am. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 2 days a week for you to listen to. Now, if you do like the show, we also do a video version of it on my YouTube channel. Just Google Vinny Eastwood YouTube. You should be able to find the channel. It's the one with nearly 30,000 odd subscribers there. Now, what was I going to talk about? Ah, yes. The Windows 7 computer. Ladies and gentlemen, American Freedom Radio is going to be turned into a bit of a video network, as well as doing the radio. And I want to, if you're listening now, I want you to rack your brain and think about who might fit this description. Somebody who doesn't use this one particular Windows 7 laptop that they've got. Maybe they've got a couple of them. And it's just sitting there. And you realize that, hey, American Freedom Radio could use that as one of its little separate audio encoders for the network. And you're going to go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and contact them, AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com, and say, hey, this guy over here has that laptop that you really, really badly need to make the network run. That's what you can do. Or desktop. Now, I think what people need to understand is that, look, Coca-Cola and Vodafone and Google, for a large degree, and the large pharmaceutical industry, are not going to fund broadcast networks like American Freedom Radio. They're not going to sponsor shows like the Vinnie Eastwood Show, not when we're ripping Seven Colors of shit out of them all the live long day. And I believe that there is an obligation on the part of the audience. If I was part of the audience, I would feel obligated, but I got obligated to actually provide you the content itself because I have a narcissistic personality disorder that makes me love the limelight. So I kind of use my evil, evil gifts to do some good. And if you have some evil, evil fiat currency that you want to get rid of to absolve you of your truth of sins, go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com and start donating today, regularly, every month. Start up a little automatic payment into the Kiwi Bank if you happen to be a New Zealand listener to support my show, because every little bit helps. It certainly, certainly does. My very special guest is David Morgan, the Silver Guru. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Vinny.
Why'd you come up with the guru kind of thing? You have some sort of silver religious experience?
No, I didn't. I mean, the 11-year-old story I gave you at the beginning is what got me. And I, at that point in my life, I had no idea that I'd be doing, you know, what I'm doing now. But no, what's so funny is that, you know, I have a bit of a sense of humor. So when I started, I actually was, you know, working, trading and consulting. And I started the web presence. And so in the early days, I needed a Hotmail account. So I went to Hotmail and I thought, well, what's a good moniker for me? And, you know, silver is my specialty. So I typed in silverguru@hotmail.com. And Hotmail said, taken. I go, really? All right. Silverguru1@hotmail.com. Taken. That wasn't that interesting. Silverguru14@hotmail.com. Taken. I'm like, what? How many silver gurus are there? They must be all over the freaking planet. So I said, all right, silverguru22@hotmail.com. Yeah, you can have that one. So that's how I came up with the Silver Guru. It was purely kind of a tongue-in-cheek. I'd never taken the moniker very seriously. Some people do. I mean, I've had people tell me, God, you really are the Silver Guru because I made some good calls or helped them out or helped them make money or whatever. But I don't take it that seriously. But that's how it all started. It was like I just needed a, you know, a domain, or not a domain, but a you know, moniker for the Hotmail account. And I came up with one. It took me about seven iterations to come up with one that I could use.
You know, it's very interesting. I've heard a number of stories like this, is that some little thing that kind of pisses you off because it's not what you wanted is actually the thing that kind of defines you and makes you what you are, right? Like, if you've ever heard of the band Daft Punk, the reason why, and they're huge, right? They're huge. They're the massivest club hitting bunch in the ever. And nobody knows what they look like. They always wear helmets. And the reason why they're called Daft Punk is because when they were teenagers, they made a little album and they went to see a producer. They said, what is this Daft Punk nonsense? And kind of like, some of the most successful people I know live their life as a perpetual kind of middle finger or FU to the people who initially didn't give them a shot. So they named themselves Daft Punk after what he called them. And Led Zeppelin, same thing. He said, this album sucks. It's going to fly like a Led Zeppelin. And if that's the case, right, do human beings thrive on opposition? Like, is tyranny rising and then getting overthrown a way of sort of the human race's way through history of refining the pecking order or purifying the genome or some shit?
I will defer that, and I'm not copping out. I think a better answer is, again, just go to my website, themorganreport.com, and get that free report and watch the Four Horsemen film, which talks about the Age of Empire and how history is cyclical and how we're at the collapse of empire right now and how it goes through the different stages, like the Age of Pioneers, where basically you're starting with, you know, dirt and an idea. And you go out as a pioneer with the right spirit, right attitude. And you, you know, as Gerald Celente says, and Bobby Dylan said it as well, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And you go out there, you explore, you, you know, you do what it takes to eke out a living and build something. So it is cyclical. I think that movie will help answer that question better than I could. And it does repeat. Yes, history does repeat. It doesn't repeat exactly, but there are memes or themes that do go. And so we're nearing the age of empire. In fact, I'm going to carry on here a moment longer because, you know, I'm pretty well studied in the topic. And I'm actually in the movie, and believe me, it's supposed to be some of the best thinkers out there. And I, you know, glad that the producers, you know, put that on there. I wouldn't consider myself, you know, a lot of my friends say I held my own, but these are my friends. But regardless, it is a thought-provoking movie. And what they talk about is at the top of the Age of Empire, what, you know, what you will see. And a lot of this I was familiar with. What I wasn't familiar with was that chefs become celebrities. And that was true during the Roman Empire when I actually stopped and thought about it. But, you know, I don't know what it's like there in New Zealand, Vinny, but here in the States, they have the iron, and I don't watch much TV, I really don't, but you can't, you know, breathe air in and out without being exposed to some of this stuff. They have the Iron Chef, and so all these chefs are idolized. They have a whole network, a whole food network, and it's like, there is proof that we're getting near the end. Go ahead.
Okay, it was only like a couple of years ago that we got like our fourth TV channel kind of thing, right? That's how behind the times we are. And when I stopped watching TV in 2012, during prime time, like around the 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock region or whatever, there'd be something like maybe 2 to 3 different cooking shows a night over the 4 networks that you could choose from during that time slot sort of thing. So it's just out of freaking control, right? People are so obsessed with taste and flavor that they've lost the taste and flavor for life itself.
Well said, Penny. Well said.
Let's think about this then. Silver is a very important resource. Where does it frickin' come from? Do you know much about the mining and the extracting and the processing of the silver? Like the actual raw boots on the ground type of stuff. Because guys actually have to get that shit, right?
Right.
I remember I interviewed Gordon Bowden, who used to design a number of large mining operations in South Africa. He kind of quit the job when one of the giant elevators with about 50 men in it had a big accident, and all the men in the cage above him kind of got crushed, and all the parts of them started kind of feeding through all the grates and dripping onto him. It was just, yeah, there's places in this world where people do real, actual work, and there's other places in this world where people get to reap the benefits of those who sometimes die doing that work.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, actually, my previous website was silver-investor.com, but I do so much more than silver. I changed the branding to the Morgan Report. The subset of silverinvestor.com was money, mining, and metals. And I know quite a bit about mining. In fact, in most of the recommendations we do throughout the resource sector, so it's not silver stocks only, it's resources like molybdenum, copper, lithium, uranium, zinc, whatever. We usually visit the mine if it's a smaller mine, and we write a report. So, yes, I do know a fair amount. It's been a passion along with the honest money syndrome for a very long time. And so where does it come from? Well, it comes from the ground. Silver is unique. There's really no such thing as a pure silver mine. It always is deposited with gold. There's like a gold-silver deposit or a silver-copper deposit primarily lead and zinc. Silver usually is deposited with lead and zinc. 70% of the silver mined out of the earth is a result of base metal mining. 25% of the silver that reaches the surface is due to copper mining. About 35% of the silver that reaches the top of the surface is due to lead and zinc mining. And believe it or not, 13% of the silver supply is a result of gold mining. So the other 25% is roughly due to other mining goods. It's not pure silver mining. So basically what I'm saying is that pure silver mine really doesn't exist. And there are some that are very high silver. In other words, mostly silver, very little gold, mostly silver, very little lead, that type of thing. But a pure silver mine doesn't exist. There used to be a few. In the early days, silver deposits, and I'm not a geologist, and some have argued with me, and I'll defer to them. But from my research, and I've been looking at the silver market for 40 years, but silver used to deposit itself near the surface. And if you go back to the conquistadors, you could actually be on one mountain looking on another mountain and see it kind of shining. And that was usually reflective silver very near the Earth's surface. So a lot of like the oil story or any of the minerals, really, the low-hanging fruit has been obtained already. And what exists below surface is harder and harder to get all the time. So it takes more energy, more manpower. But things become more efficient that we talked about earlier about like the mobile phone. So your efficiencies get better because you learn how to mine better. In fact, I'm going to go off on a road here for a minute, but there may be some real silver enthusiasts listening to the show. My predecessor, the original silver guru, if I can use that term, was named Jerome Smith. He wrote Silver Prophets in the 70s, Silver Prophets in the 80s, was behind a new boom in silver, the coming currency collapse, and several other books. And I was a big student of his. And he was talking about $200 silver by like 1985. And I was speaking at a resource show. I speak all over the world on the precious metals, on this money, and the economic collapse. And at one of these shows, the host said, I am tired of hearing this, supply deficit in silver, and we're going to see these astronomically high numbers. And, I've heard that for years. We heard that in the 70s, for crying out loud. What gives, David? And, are you lying? I mean, he basically said it that strongly. And I said, no. I said, if you go back and research, it took me a while to figure it out, but, I just read the book like three times, not repetitively, but I read it and put it down. I go, where did he make his mistake? He's a smart guy. And I read it again, and I just, the light bulb came on. So by the time he had finished that book, his last book, saying that due to the supply-demand fundamentals, he saw silver going to $200 by the mid-80s, the mining industry changed. New technology. So what used to be uneconomic silver deposits became super deposits. And so I'll put it in plain English. If you go back and look at the data, and it's in his book, the most silver you could ever get out of the ground in a given year was 365 million ounces. And that went back for decade after decade after decade after decade. So you got this ceiling, 365 million ounces. As soon as the ink dried on that book, they started doing heat leach cyanide. And the production rate of silver went from 365 million ounces annually to where we are today of about 800 million ounces, about triple. Well, 2.5 times. So he made a grave mistake. He made an assumption that was invalid. He thought that the most you'd ever get was 365, which the data backed up, but he didn't think ahead that there may be a new technology that comes along that is able to extract silver at a high, more efficient rate than we do today. So I learned that lesson very solidly. So when people tell me, in your book, you say that the peak silver is going to happen over the next 3 to 4 years. Now, there's a big caveat in that chapter. It says, based on today's technology, because something could happen, maybe we'll be able to mine the ocean floor very efficiently. Right now, we can't, but that doesn't mean 10 years from now we won't be able to. So thanks for letting me take that little detour.
Well, I find it's like the tree of life, okay? It's tangent tree. It's got branches that kind of go out and all little things, but they all connect to the roots in the end. And this thing about money and the value of it, what kind of, shall we say, centralized value is there to technology's sake? Is it like, is there p- particular types of very useful and advanced technologies that need actual silver in the working parts, etc., to work? Or is it mostly just its monetary value and its resource in that way?
No, I'm glad we're getting on this topic, because half of the silver story is monetary and the other half is industrial. If you go back about 12, 13 years, what you'll find is the industrial usage of silver is about 35% of the total market. Today, it's 54%, or just over half of the total market is used for silver in industrial applications. This is everything to do. First of all, silver conducts electricity better than any element. It reflects light better than any element. And it conducts heat better than any element. So you can see the applications in solar, for example. There's about 70 million ounces annually used in solar panels because it produces electricity. To carry electricity, there's something called superconductivity, which uses silver, which is highly efficient. There's not practically zero line loss when you use superconductivity. That uses silver. The biocide properties of silver are very well known from the medieval times. And right now, Vinny, for your listeners, and this is important to get out of caveat, I'm not a doctor, so do it at your own risk. Tune up, people. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio, so tune in. So there are pathogens that cannot be killed by any antibiotic known to man right now, but silver will still take care of that. That's my opinion, folks. I'm not a scientist, nor am I.
That, however, is an opinion backed up by scientists and doctors. For example, Dr. Rima Labo, who's a colloidal silver, was sent to a country in Africa, I think, during that big Ebola outbreak, and they managed to kill the Ebola. And the government itself actually commended Dr. Rima for saving their people, right, from that kind of disease and plague.
It also cures, takes care of malaria. I stayed in the background on the whole colloidal silver thing for a long time because my reputation is pretty pure. I'm not, you know, I have no halo over my head, but I'm a straight shooter and I have high integrity, and people trust me, as they should. And so I just kind of backed out of the colloidal silver thing. And I decided a few years ago to go ahead and do it. And I did it in a way that suits me best, which is it's not me saying it. I was the interviewer. I interviewed two top doctors, both brilliant, and we became friends. And it's on the web somewhere. I have to kind of find it myself. But if you typed into Google David Morgan, pH balance silver, or thank you silver, something like that will pop up. But anyway, yes, there is something about silver's properties that are very, very important from a biocide perspective. And thanks for throwing it in about Ebola. The other thing is there's another guy on YouTube that you can actually take like a silver dollar, a silver coin that you have, and you can charge your cell phone with it. Silver is a fascinating metal from what the industrial uses are. So everything electronic or electrical has silver in some way, shape, or form. The most efficient batteries really aren't lithium batteries. They're actually silver-based, but you don't see them or hear about it. They're military use because of what's called mil-spec, military specifications. And, you know, I'd love to get with Mr. Elon Musk, and he probably knows this. I mean, he's a very smart guy, but, you know, he's kind of committed to the lithium story now, and that's fine. It's his business. But imagine running around on silver zinc batteries, or the highest efficiency battery available that will run your laptop for, you know, 7 weeks before you have to recharge or something like that. I'm exaggerating for effect, but it lasts a lot longer. But these are things kind of in the background, but there's all kinds of things that come to the fore. And then moving into the nano world, and I don't know why, and the scientists don't know why, and I'm fairly studied on this topic, and there's probably a listener or two out there that knows more about this than me, but silver has been used in nanotechnology to be able to, let's say chemically or molecularly is probably a better word, molecularly put together strands at the nano level that wouldn't be accomplished unless silver was involved. They don't know why. It just is like, you know, it's the good buddy metal or something. It's like, okay, we want to get this substrate of graphene to do this, so we'll add silver and we'll do it. And I just made that up for effect, but I'm trying to make the point. So there's a lot going on with silver from the nano world all the way up to, you know, still even the photography, which of course has been pretty much discontinued with the digital cameras today. but always new uses. In fact, silver is number two. There's more patents for byproducts from the oil industry than any other commodity. But the second most useful is silver. So just all kinds of things that are, you know, silver-based. And it's a technology metal. I've made the joke, but it's also true that if you're really a technology type, the best technology stock you can buy is a bar of silver because it's used in so many technical applications. Of course, an iPhone has a lot of exotic metals in it and all that, but they also use silver. And I used to say, and I was incorrect. Well, I was correct at the time, but not anymore. But, you know, I have a smartphone like almost everybody these days. But if you go back 15 years, the flip phones back in those days, I was telling people from the stage that the silver in there was not economically viable to melt the cell phones down. Because by the time you transported it, crushed it, melted it down, and extracted the silver, and all that labor and energy used to get a little bit of silver, it was, you know, costing you, you know, $50 an ounce to get it out. And silver at the time was selling for, let's say, $5. So obviously they just end up in the landfill. No longer true with the smartphones. The smartphones actually have 3 grams of gold per cell phone. And some of the marginal mines have 1 gram of gold per ton. So a cell phone is 3 times stronger in its gold content than some of the marginal mines that are mined by major mining houses like Newmont, for example.
There's actually a lot of people, they call them gold bugs, who go around and find all the old cell phones and everything and just to get the gold out of them and then go and trade them in.
Yeah, and of course, if you're going to smelt it down for the gold, you're going to take the copper and the silver and whatever other metals come with it.
As they say in the industry, who smelt it, dealt it.
Another injection of the Vinny Eastwood Show. I love people laugh at jokes. That's awesome.
I crack me up. I do. Okay.
So, I mean, we could go on, but I mean, the major things in on the industrial side are solar, medical, electrical, high tech, nanotech, and of course, the monetary aspect is what's really going to drive the silver price, because as the monetary system unravels further, people will look for a way to protect themselves, and gold will be priced out of the average person's budget. So when gold goes to pick a number, because it varies person to person, but it goes to 2,500 or 3,000 US, and silver is at, say, 60 or 65 or whatever it is, people are going to say, God, I'd love to get an ounce of gold. But you know what? I don't have $3,500. I don't want to come to the back, you know, from the coin shop with one coin and my wife beating on me. So I'm going to buy silver. And since the silver market is so much smaller than the gold market, but a lot more affordable, you'll see that the gold-silver spread will change, meaning that silver will outperform gold. And I think silver will outperform gold by at least 300%. So $1,000 invested in gold would be, and whatever it does, let's say it goes up tenfold, would go up 30-fold in the silver market. Or if you think gold's only going to double, it'd probably go up 6-fold. Now, I'm talking about the extreme high of the market. I'm not talking about day after tomorrow. I'm not talking about 2016. I'm talking about when the panic starts, because there'll be a synergy of reasons for people to buy precious metals. It'll be a further deterioration of the global empire, so the empire starts to unwind even more than it already has. It'll be financial mistrust. It will be currency mistrust. It will be pensions failing. It will be basically a panic mode, and a fear-driven market is about the most driven market of any market. I mean, greed drives people, and greed will drive a market much higher, but fear will drive it even higher and faster, because when people are scared, don't get in their way. It's, you know, and I hate to use it. Well, I don't mind using the analogy, you know, this screaming fire in the theater. And that's what will happen to the precious metals markets. And I have no way to control that. So you're really better off, you know, getting your, you know, getting out of the theater before everyone has a rush to get out of it.
Or just sit in your seats and just go, I don't see no flames, bro. I was also talking to some Irishman one time about this, about the economic collapse and things that are actually valuable into it. Booze and drugs, right? If you stockpile cigarettes, marijuana, any kind of illegal drug or whatever, during a depression, you'll be surprised at how many people want to escape being depressed. You know, and how much they're willing to pay. in order to get that way. Now,
and toilet paper, like you said.
Now, fear. Also, to reiterate that point about not losing your head in a crisis as being the key to survival here. And that's because during a fight or flight response, shutting down frontal lobe activity and operating on instinct in the bottom of the reptilian brain is what will keep you alive, because that was what will propel you either at that animal that you can kill or away from that animal that can kill you, the fight or flight. So when you are afraid, that is operating. Now, that means your frontal lobe, your higher thinking processes, get shut off during that time. And it's only supposed to happen for a very short period of time. Typically, you'd take 1 minute to 90 seconds to get away from a predator in a survival situation. That's a lot of running. 1 minute, you can fit a lot of steps into it. And that's when a whole lot of human growth hormone and a number of other things get released. But when you're tense all the time, the human growth hormone and these other beneficial hormones stop getting pumped into the bloodstream, and it starts producing cortisol, which starts to eat away at muscle tissue. And what we're dealing with right now is a society that's been under a sense of anxiety for so long that its own fear has caused it not only to become stupid, but also weak.
Yes, you're right.
Right? We're getting fear pumped out in us and everything. And not to insult you or anything, but this fear of financial collapse, I think, is one of these many contributing factors. Because of its uncertainty, because we don't know when it's going to collapse, and I feel that there's maybe a responsibility on the behalf of all people. If you're going to tell somebody the very scary truth, the very least you can do at the same time is tell them how to cope with that very scary truth. And that's why I like to do humor and all of these kind of things. I mean, hey, just because the economy is collapsing and 90% of the people are going to die of starvation doesn't mean you can't have a laugh about it.
Oh, you're killing me. Well, we don't know if it's going to be that grave or not, but one of my favorite quotes is, chance favors the prepared mind. And you know, I've been thinking about it for a long time, but I don't obsess about it. There were probably periods in my life where I did for a while, but you know, the main thing is, what can you control? And one of the, again, coming back to kind of the theme of your show is, you know, on this discussion with me, is, you know, is you yourself, you know, be solid in yourself and what your capabilities are. I mean, if you can grow food, grow food. If you have some skill set that would be good on let's say a grid down situation, or let's say less availability of what we take for granted today, then nurture that skill set, you know, that type of thing. But again, it comes back, I think, to attitude. If you've got the right attitude, you're going to probably do much better than if you're surrounding yourself with a bunch of survival food and a bunch of guns and all that. And a community, that's something very, very big. You know, the open head, open heart doesn't mean that you welcome everybody that comes to your door. But what it does mean is you build a good community ahead of time so that things start to go awry. You are already prepared with a group that, you know, it's pretty well prepared minded, or at least of a mindset that, hey, we get through this together. You do this, I do that. It goes kind of back to the division of labor thing. I mean, you know, it's like the tribal format, and there's nothing wrong with the tribe. I mean, even in, you know, you look at the American Indian, and I'm not well studied in this, but, you know, grandma had a role. I mean, grandma sat around and taught the kids a lot of things, and they had wisdom. I mean, in most cultures, except our sick one, old people were revered. And it was kind of an instinctual thing, because you think someone that survived for 70 or 80 years must have learned a lot about life and could probably pass that on to someone. But these days, it's all about youth and, you know, all this stuff.
I was with two Maori gentlemen, and they both served in the armed forces. One had served in World War II, and one had served in Desert Storm. And the one who served in Desert Storm was like, got to the rank of captain. He had this very captainish type of kind of vibe about him, you know, that authoritative. And he didn't show me any respect. And he would like interrupt me when I would speak and things like that, because I'm the young guy at the table, right? And just met these guys when we were out drinking, filming a gig, that kind of thing. And needed to get my mate laid. So, I'm good like that. It had a conversation with these people, but I noticed that whenever the elder spoke, he would shut up instantly. All right, had that kind of respect, and it was only because he was an elder. It didn't matter that the elder really respected me, and we got along really well, and we were communicating perfectly, as elders and the youth often do, right? And that was the thing that kind of perplexed me the most, is that if you're sharing knowledge openly, forthcomingly, and you're not kind of looking at it like, oh, somebody's got this level that I need to obtain in order to have respect or whatever. It's just, you get respect just for whatever you are and whatever you are at that point. But I found that that respect doesn't really exist anymore unless the position of power had been given to you, right? Like a teacher gets respected by their students in front of their face, but not behind their back. It's because they haven't actually earned that respect. They just got given to them. And I wonder, is that kind of like what's replaced the respect of the elders and the respect for those people who have actually earned it is simply respecting authority for the sake of it. And because it's got done nothing to earn it, we as a society are breaking under our own weight.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that... You know, you look at it, it comes back to integrity. I mean, if you look at it from, you know, I'll veer off the road here and go to Robert Bly. You can look him up on the internet, but he was one of the, he wrote Iron John, and he kind of started the men's movement. And he talked about, you know, the only ones in our society that really have the respect are the drug lords, you know. And it's like, well, you know, I'm kind of neutral on drugs, to be honest about it, but I'm not a favorer of, you know, people killing others for drugs. But anyway, coming back onto the point, what Robert Bly said was that it gives these younger men an authority that they can respect, because these guys do what they say. You know, you show up with this much money, and if you don't, guess what? You might not be living the next day. I mean, that kind of thing. I'm not trying to be too harsh. I'm trying to serve. And this shows you how convoluted this society becomes. And this is one of the main premises of myself and Robert Prechter, probably the other one that leads in this field, that there is a direct correlation between the debasement of the currency and the debasement of society at large. In other words, as the financial and monetary systems get more and more corrupted, the moral structure of society gets more and more corrupted, to where now the only ones that you can respect are people that are drug lords, not the president of the United States. Not for some criminal contraption that who knows what she's doing. And I'm not pro the other guy either, believe me. But, you know, this is the deterioration that we've witnessed across the globe. And particularly, I mean, I don't know what you guys think of the U.S. Political system. But, I mean, I know if I, you know, when I go to Europe, well, yeah, I don't have to go anywhere to know that, I mean, a lot of these people have absolutely lost respect for us as a country. We don't do what we say we're going to do. We say we're bringing democracy to everybody. Let's talk about democracy for a minute. I mean, democracy comes from the Latin word of mobocracy, which in the Latin is mob rule. I mean, we don't have a democracy. Everyone says we're only bringing democracy to the world. You know, what we're bringing to the world is mob rule. But this country was built, as we talked earlier in the show, it's built on it's a constitutional republic, where you have inalienable rights and everyone's equal under the law, which means the same rights, rules, and accountability for everybody. But no, that's not true anymore. It's Animal Farm. All animals are created equal, except some animals are more equal than other animals. Oh, does the name Hillary ring a bell for you?
I think it was Julian Assange said it best. Trying to decide between Trump and Hillary is like trying to decide between cholera and gonorrhea. You know, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah, I mean, God, it's not the hopelessness. Political atheism. I wonder that what would be interesting is if you actually were in a political internment prison, how long you'd last, you know? Oh, God. Because I always thought of being locked away in a FEMA camp would be great. You know, it'd be like a reunion. It's like, oh, I know how you got in here, bro. Oh. It's go play some volleyball behind the double fences. I mean, people are like really afraid of the end of the world. But at the same time, I saw this very good speech made by Hugh Laurie in a film called Tomorrowland, which bombed at the cinemas, and probably for this reason. He talked about how the end of the world has become an entertainment vessel. You can enjoy the end of the world any way you want. You can enjoy it as a video game. You can enjoy it as a movie. You can enjoy it as a mural on the airport wall or something like that. It's just become a great entertainment. And I like madness because it, for some reason, it entertains me, okay? And I've found that when the madness stops being funny, that's when you need to adopt it to a large degree. You know, become one with the craziness, you know, because what do you got to lose, bro? If somebody were to say to you, Vinny, you're freaking insane, I'd say, well, thank you. Yeah, but what? why are you thanking me? Well, because if you look at how fucking insane the world is, I'll take that as a compliment. Okay? It's a topsy-turvy world, so you can turn craziness into sanity any day of the week and vice versa. The thing is, to not let it take you to that other side so far that you can't come back.
Right. You know? Well, you're saying one of the things that has been not a real struggle for me, but I've worked at it, and that's balance. I mean, nature preaches balance, you know, and there's too many of this kind of fish, then this other fish eats it, or there's too many flies, then whatever takes up, you know, and balance. And that when we just strive for that in the human experience, you know, if you look at the end of the world as infotainment, and, you know, a lot of people, I don't know how many, but listen to shows like yours or the interviews I give or whatever, and it sounds really great, but they don't take it seriously. They're not buying silver. They're not buying extra food. They're not putting extra water back or any of that stuff. It's just, it's entertainment to them. It's like, wow, that sounds really scary. And they kind of get this kind of, in my opinion, sort of this sick little adrenaline rush, or maybe this little attachment to the reptilian brain. Oh, man, that sounds, ooh. But they just go on with this normalcy bias that we spoke about earlier where, you know, oh, he's full of it. You know, it sounds good, Martha, but the stores are always going to be there. We don't have to worry about anything. Our president told us that the economy is so great that anyone that says it isn't is peddling fiction. I heard him say that on the TV.
Oh, my God. I remember the one time I was protesting John Key, our former Federal Reserve financial frickin' assassin, right? And some guy drives past me, he's done great for the economy, and it's like that was the same week that we went over $100 billion of debt for 4 million people. And it comes full circle, because you wanted to do this rant when we ended the first hour about everyone having an opinion without thinking.
Right. It's one of my pet peeves. I mean, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion. And I suppose that's true. I won't argue that. But often I am asked, you know, well, what's your opinion on this? And I kind of pride myself on the ability to say, I haven't formed an opinion on that because I haven't studied it long enough to form an opinion. Now, whether that makes me classy, elegant, or a schmuck, I don't know, and I don't care. But what I'm trying to convey is that critical thinking is lost in our culture. It's something that's really imperative. If you really want to get ahead and you really want to be your own person, you need to study logic. And then after that, you need to start practicing critical thinking and not accept something at face value. In other words, don't accept anything I say. Look it up. Do your own research. Dig in. You know, form an opinion. You know, I look at the left and I look at the right all the time because I want to be able to see both sides of the story. And I would lean probably more to the right politically, even though I am pretty much a political atheist. I try to seek the truth, and the truth has no boundaries, and it's not left or right. It's the truth. But coming back on point, the left, from my opinion, and this is mine, is that I think they're very good-hearted for the most part. I know there's some that, you know, cause, you know, beat up people. I don't want to use specific examples. I think for the most part, they're well-meaning. They just don't have a deeper understanding of how a viable economic system really works. And the idea of, you know, competition scares the crap out of them, you know. So instead of being the same under the law, where we all have the same rules, laws, and accountability. It's like, well, if you're handicapped with this persuasion, you get extra brownie points and extra brownie points. And if you, you know, you got this and you get extra brownie points, and all of a sudden you're the class president, because to make up for the deficiencies of some perception, you know, you rise to the top because you have to be equal by somebody else by this. Not everyone was created equal. Going back, and I hope I'm not making this too convoluted, but all animals are created equal. Some of them are equal than others. No, you really get there on your own merits. I mean, when the founding fathers talked about we're all created equal, they weren't talking about everyone could play in the NFL or the NBA. They were talking that we're all human and that we all have those God-given rights. So if we were short or fat or whatever, that wasn't what they were talking about. They're talking about you are a human being, and by your very presence. And by the way, you know, I'm going to go rant on this for a moment. You know, a lot of people are, you know, the self-esteem thing, and I haven't really figured that one out. I still form an opinion on that, but oh, I don't have high self-esteem. Well, do esteemable acts, you'll get self-esteem. So that's an answer to that one. And the other thing is, you know, you won the most important race out there to be born, you know. So if you don't think you're tall enough or good looking enough or smart enough or whatever, you won the most important race out there. You won the sperm race. You came one out of a million, and that sperm is what fertilized that egg. So you are a winner. If you're breathing in and out, you are a winner. You won that most important race, the sperm race, and here you are. So deal with it. You know, deal with it and be self motivated. I mean, this idea of being able to critically think and know yourself, you know, the Oracle of Delphi, what's over the top of it, thy own self be true. You know, if you're solid in who you are, and Vinnie Eastwood certainly is, and he set a good example, especially for younger people, which I admire. Cause I want my message to get everywhere, especially to the younger generation. I'm not going to be around a whole lot longer. But
by the way, the younger generation don't listen. I had a look at the analytics, yeah, and it's like for the truth movement, it's between 80% and 90% over the age of 25 in terms of the listenership. And I think that's because you need to see about maybe 20 to 25 years of New World Order scumbaggery in your daily life before you start to think that maybe something might be up. Maybe. It's a theory.
Yeah. Good. Well, good. Well, at least you're doing what you can, and that's good. And it may shift down. I don't know. But anyway, I think I've said enough on that topic, but thanks for bringing me around to that, because it's really critically important to find balance in your life, to look at it realistically, to know what you can control and what you cannot control, and get solid in and of yourself, and deal with people that you know, that you genuinely like you said earlier. You know, you don't have to like everybody, or it's my friend, or no one else likes him, or whatever. I mean, you really want, I mean, life's too short to just make it a dress rehearsal. It's not a dress rehearsal. It's real. So be real. Buy real. Get real.
Go bobbing for apples. Bobbing for turds never helped anybody. Now, it echoes similar thoughts to what I was saying on Facebook earlier today. Seeing evidence before believing in something is essential, but that's the easy part. Accepting possibilities, the unknown, the unseen, and things which are outside your control is the hard part.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't, I mean, if you look at purportedly what went on with like the moon landing, right? I mean, you thought about it conventionally. You'd send a rocket and it'd land on the moon and then it'd come back. And there was no way you could do that. You couldn't have store enough energy to do that. So what do? Well, you get the rocket up there and then you put it in an orbit around the moon, and then you make a lunar module that comes off the rocket and goes down there. Now, that's an efficient way. It's something that somebody had to think of, because the conventional thinking was, we'll fly up and we'll fly back. No, it's not going to work. So, you know, that's just a corny example, perhaps, but it's, again, outside the box thinking. And just, you know, to add to what you're saying, Vinny, because there's so many possibilities, but and that comes from critical thinking. That comes from being able to think outside the box, not being told to think. And, you know, the whole education. I mean, another thing I didn't mention in my beginning rant, you know, the corruption, the educational system, totally corrupt. These kids come out and they don't know how to balance a checkbook. They don't know what GMO food means. They are taught to obey. You know, don't think, obey, consume. Don't think, obey, consume. You know, freedom is slavery. War is peace. And ignorance is, you know, not bliss, but whatever it was in 1984. And that's it. And this is the way we've gone. And but the end, I think, is coming. I think that the counter revolution is before us, and hopefully it won't get too violent or violent, although it obviously has been in many places. I mean, you know, and now was it the IMF? Any help me out here? That came out recently and said, yeah, we really screwed up with Greece. You know, we really shouldn't have done what we did with giving them all this hardship and this extra money that they never can pay back and all this crap. And it's like, really?
It was their own man who used to be part of the IMF, Papademos, who became their leader during the middle of the crisis and wound up, funnily enough, making the crisis worse.
Yeah, how strange how these things don't work out.
I just didn't see it coming. I just didn't see it coming.
It's a whacked out world.
Yeah, people talk about how the education system isn't working. That's not true. It's working incredibly well.
Well said. Yeah, it's working exactly how they want it to work.
I mean, you think that if it wouldn't work in the way they want it to, they got enough money and resources and scumbaggery, they could change it, right? If they really wanted to. But no, yeah. No, they don't. It just keeps getting worse. Now, the education system in America is encapsulated by one sentence said by an American president: is our children learning?
Another guy that said he visited all 57 states.
Oh, my God. I mean, people are working hard out there to put food on their family. You know, I actually miss the days of Bush, because at least then the presidential speeches were fun and funny. Because now it's just Barack Obobblehead who just swings from one end, who just sings from one side. He's like the Stevie Wonder of politics, just from one teleprompter to the left. BS, BS. I want to get like a little Barack Obobble for my car, so that when I drive, he looks at his two little teleprompters and tells me lies. Oh, God. Oh, the marketing and the franchise. I could just see the amount of money rolling in from people who just really, really love Obama, and they'll think that it's not a joke. But anyway, the misleading of the general population in almost every conceivable direction is one of the things that frustrates people who don't get misled, you see? Because when you're sitting there in a crowd and somebody goes, "Free vaccines for everybody!" The one guy in the crowd is going, "I don't want that, bro." Everybody else is going, "Yay!" like at a Bill Gates convention or some shit like that. The mind reels, and it hurts you. It hurts you in your brain places to see other people being misled and to know that you can't stop them. It's like being the one cow who sees the cliff in the middle of a stampede and going, "Hey, everybody, stop! Don't go off the cliff." Oh, they're off the cliff.
Yeah, awesome. That's awesome. And it leads to leadership, because when that one cow says, "I'm not jumping off the cliff," and it's always a herd mentality, and we as human beings do go to the beehive of the herd mentality. But what happens is that one cow, or we'll say that one person, decides, "I'm not going there." So they take off and they're all alone. The leader starts off, and then another cow looks and says, "You know what? I don't think I want to die. This is stupid." So he gets, you know, behind the leader or starts walking off the same direction. And then that starts to gain momentum. And all of a sudden, over time, we see people go, or the cows go, as the analogy, in a different direction. And that's really, again, what's taking place now. Shows like yours and other places. I mean, you look at like what David Stockman writes. I mean, he's brilliant and a truth teller. And, you know, there's many out there in the counter-revolution that are doing a lot of good if people take the time to find them and read or listen. And this is that one cow, that two cow, that 10 cows that are going in a different direction. I mean, in a way, part of me, and this may sound a bit sick, I'm kind of rooting for the collapse. Now, I know when I go to the grocery store and, you know, the shelves are half wiped out and you can't get grapes any time of the year, I use that as a metaphor for how abundant things are right now. People, you know, just don't understand. I mean, I'm old enough to know, you know, going back into my history. I mean, when I was like 10 or 11 and we went to the grocery store, like you went through a shelf and there were like two kinds of ketchup, Heinz and Hunt's, and that was it. I mean, now you've got, you know, 472 brands of pickles. You know, you got sandwich slice with crinkles and a twist of lime. I mean, it's the age of plenty, but that age of plenty is the top, not the bottom. And we're getting very wobbly at the top, and things are starting to unravel, as we all know. And that, again, is a metaphor for where we're going to be in just a few short years. So we are starting to unravel, unwind, and collapse. The collapse usually isn't instantaneous. It takes time. And again, from 2008 till now, it really hasn't gotten any better, although they've tried to paper over it. And maybe the people that manipulate the stock markets are doing better financially. But, you know, the top elite in the monetary sphere are, you know, a total subset that's so small that it's meaningless to the average man and woman on the planet. I mean, it's just a whole different world almost to what, you know, compared to the rest of us. But so I'm a little lost, and I'll give it back to you, but we can drill down any other topics that you want. And just again, I guess to repeat, the important thing is, you know, really get solid with your own education. One thing about the internet is there's a lot of stuff out there that's probably a waste of your time. In a true free market, you have to use discernment. You have to be able to determine whether something's true or false for yourself. And that's a good way to do it, because at least you know when you do it. But there's a lot of vital information out there, and you can really become self-educated on almost any topic. I remember when the internet started, geez, I would sit there and I'd be up till 2 or 3 in the morning because I want to know everything. And it was all on the internet. And I would sit there thinking, oh, I've been here reading for an hour or two. And of course, I could hardly see. And I look at my watch, God, it's 2 in the morning again. I guess I better get some rest. But I was so fascinated with the opportunity to learn everything. And of course, no one can. But God, all these topics that I kind of like, you know, didn't have time to go to the library or whatever, but I could type in, oh, I wonder what this is, and type it in. And, oh, my goodness, look at that. And just sort of get sucked in. But I love to learn. And the internet gives us the opportunity to be lifelong learners and to do the counter to the authority figures. Instead of being dumbed down, it's smarten up because we have that availability.
Yeah, other people have to dumb you down. You are the one who has to smarten yourself up. And the internet has also given us trolling and arguing with people all the time, and memes and things like that. And I saw a great meme with a guy who was sitting at his desk, and it was late at night, and his wife's leaning through the door. Honey, are you going to come to bed? And he goes, no, someone is wrong on the internet.
Classic.
So that's the kind of stuff you get here at the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've enjoyed it. David Morgan has been my very special guest. His book here, The Silver Manifesto, is the one that you can get, and it will be wonderful and fabulous and all sorts of good things with lots of information in there. It's like, it's thick and it's got like pictures and stuff. I like it. I like it. And I also wanted to thank the listener who sent me these little Aussie coins that are quite lovely. And thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a listener-supported broadcast. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Start donating regularly today if you want this kind of thing to continue, because otherwise, with an uninformed population, we won't stand a chance against these scum. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again sometime. Thank you.